Now, he may have stayed with the 4th Divisional Signals for a time, but I doubt if he was there very long. Now, I used to see some of them as time went on, you see. Mm-hmm. But
you still weren't a signal corps yet. You were still
we were
signaler in the engineers.
Signaler engineers.
Yeah.
Mind you, the old 1st Divisional people, they, like Buddy Weeks, they still wore their badges. And we were allowed to wear those badges if we found them and could wear them.
Mm-hmm.
I had some.
You're talking about the signal badge?
The original signal badges, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Do you have any left?
I have some of the buttons left.
Yes, and that's right.
I gave an awful lot of that stuff down to the museum at Vinnie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll bless myself. Well, then you were during Passchendaele, now that'd be November 1917.
Yes, yeah.
You were back taking this course on,
yeah.
Yeah. How long was that?
Well, it was all the time they were at Passchendaele anyway.
Yeah.
Of course, they weren't there too long, I don't think.
No, thank God.
No.
Far too long,
I
suppose.
Oh,
that
I know,
way. Yeah.
I know.
Did you ever see it yourself?
No.
Yeah.
No, I never saw it.
I saw it in peacetime.
Did you?
And it looked very peaceful.
Yeah.
But oh God, from everything I've read about it.
Well, I during the advance around Amiens and so on, that was a very exciting time. We got some new equipment. Early and before then, we had a number of artillery signalers came in to us for training with new sets known as the Woolwich set.
The which?
The Woolwich. The Woolwich set.
Yeah.
And they were used valves for transmitting,
mm-hmm.
and receiving.
Mm-hmm.
And were very, very much superior to anything we had had.
That would be the first transmitter with a valve in it, rather than a spark coil.
That was the first transmitter with a valve instead of a spark coil.
That's a real break. That's
Yes.
break.
Oh yes.
From
yes.
Communication point.
So far as I know, the Germans did not have valves at that time.
No.
Now we.
That Reg, that's a vacuum tube.
Vacuum tube.
Yeah.
We had some.
Mm-hmm.
We had some. Which were used as amplifiers by the interception service.
Mm-hmm.
We had, in the wireless section, we had these ITOC people, these interception people, worked with us.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked with way up forward. And the first amplifier they had was what we call the French piano. It was a big thing about that square and that high, and took I don't know how many batteries to run it.
Mm-hmm.
It took two men to carry the thing, you see, and I don't know how many to carry the batteries. And it wasn't terribly good either, I don't think. But anyway, that was hooked up to either a loop laid as close to the front line as they could get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there was loose conversation going on, why, and these were German-speaking people.
Ah, I see.
German-speaking people.
Yeah.
One of them was a good friend of mine later on in years, and was a professor of German at University of Toronto. Serrerus, S-U-R-E-R-U-S.
It's a fascinating point, Fred, because I've been in this business for over 50 years.
Yeah.
And I've never heard about this loop and this French piano, you call it?
Yeah.
The first time I've ever heard about
yeah.
it.
Okay.
And I think it's something that should be recorded.
Yeah.
Well, that was it. And I'll tell you, another fellow was Jack Sturdy. Now, to the best of my knowledge, Jack Sturdy became a deputy minister out in Saskatchewan one time. But Serrerus I knew very well. He was a Canadian, and so was Sturdy. And then we had a Russian. We had a Russian there. And I don't remember all the names. I have I have a list somewhere of nearly all those early operators, and some of them I can't distinguish between the early ones and the late in some cases. But those are a couple of the people on the intelligence work.
Well, now, this German chap you speak of, for example, Cereras.
Yeah.
Would he be, he would have a knowledge of German.
Yes.
Did he also have a knowledge of wireless? Or would you...
No, he didn't need to have a knowledge of wireless.
You would take it down in German as it came through.
He would take it down in German, yes.
Yeah, and give it to him and he
Yes.
I see.
Yeah. I don't think they took down any code at all. If there was any code they picked up over that circuit, but they were listening for telephone stuff.
Now, again...
May I ask Colonel Laurie a question?
Yeah.
The internet you used in those days, I presume, the International Morse.
Exactly.
So their Morse and ours was...
Yeah.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
In other words, their Morse, A was A and B was B, the same as in our one.
Yeah. Now, when you speak about a loop...
Would
this be something that's... up in the air?
I just laid it on the ground.
You laid it on the ground?
Laid it on the ground. Had to be inconspicuous, you see.
Yeah.
They laid it on the ground as close to the front lines as their front lines as they get. Out in no man's land.
Good Lord.
And
that's the size of the loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how large.
Roughly how big would the loop be?
I don't know. It'd be several hundred yards.
Oh, several hundred yards?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well,
I was thinking of 50 or 60 feet.
Well, it would be quite the size.
Yeah.
The whole loop. Say maybe 100 yards wide.
Good look. Yeah.
Now, also, they used, for that, they used a couple of earth pins driven in the ground at some distance apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that also was used for picking it up.
Yeah. And this was an operation at the Corps headquarters, presumably.
Well, yes, it was all at Corps.
I
don't know that interception stuff ever went down to the divisions. They had wireless sections from 1917 on, but I don't think they had the interception stuff like that.
In case there's some misunderstanding here, so these loops are laid up near the front line, not at Corps.
Front line, yes.
Yeah.
But the message going back
there.
I was just wondering, if this unit was working under Corps.
Oh, it was working under Corps auspices, yes.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
With the section RAM was part of the Corps wireless section.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, I see.
Well, they did a good job. But they were serviced by the same people, you see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, later on, we got some. Two or three stage amplifiers, British made, which were just so long, so wide, and probably needed just as big a battery, but they were quite good. In fact, I've got the transformers and the sockets and everything that belongs to one of the amplifiers.
You have them now.
I have them. Yeah. The only thing I haven't got is a British valve.
Be hard to get now.
No, I'll tell you. You remember when what's his name took us over to this junk shop over here in Esquimalt?
Oh yes.
I'm sure they'll have them.
Oh well. Good God. This was Lynn. I can't remember my bloody name. Bill remembers everything, and I can't. Lynn McMullen.
Hamilton that took us over there.
Colonel Hamilton.
Bill Hamilton,
He
found, he had a great big jug shop he found over there, and they had valves or tubes by the hundreds, the thousands.
Well, if you know the tube, I'll get the bloody thing for you.
As a matter of fact, there's a Montreal company.
Yeah.
In their ad, it's SNC or something, or one of those companies. And they have a picture of one of these British R tubes or A tubes The R were the receiving ones, and the A's were the transmitter. Take a little more voltage on them.
Bill, before I go, will you give me enough description? Because the fellow who was in charge of all the repair and maintenance of things was a signaler. It's a civilian now. And I'm bloody sure I can get one for you if they exist here.
Well,
you just let me get the...
Well, anyway... That's about all I know about the interception business in those days.
Yeah.
But we made great use of this continuous wave wireless, and this Willett set, and they brought out two or three other larger sets, and at the end of the war, there's the 120-watt set, and there's a picture of it.
Oh, my word.
Before that, there was a Tyrrell set.
Yeah.
And we got a hold of that. It was supposed to be mounted in a vehicle. We got that and tore it all to pieces and remounted it and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite good.
Before that, it was ICW, was it?
Pardon?
It was ICW before the CW.
No.
What do you mean by ICW?
Interrupted.
Interrupted.
No.
Continues.
Well, the interrupted CW was... just the same as a spark.
Yeah.
Same as a spark set. You could get that without your vacuum tube being oscillating, you see.
Right.
Okay, the same sort of thing.
No. Yeah.
Now the Germans, one of their field sets was a bicycle driven set with a 500 cycle alternator.
Good God.
And a quenched gap. I never saw the set itself, well, at least I don't think I did, but I have a quenched gap, and I had one of the alternators. I brought them home in my kit bag.
Good.
Arthur Steele sent home one of the generators, which is in the museum now.
Mm-hmm.
But I used that after the war as my ham set. I coupled up this alternator to an old gasoline engine and strung a couple of lines from the barn to the house, and I had about a 200-watt wireless set with 500-cycle alternator and this quenched gap, which is a series of copper plates.
Mm-hmm.
With a silver ring on each side in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and separated by a mica gasket.
Yeah, that was a...
And about four of them, all in a...
So all the gaps were mica?
All in a frame with a screw on the top to tighten them down. Well, that's what the Germans used. And it was used before the war in some installations. Well, it means that it does what it says. It quenches the spark. So that you don't get all the side effects.
Yeah.
And I used that when I was going to college. I had call letters of 3KK, and I used to talk to people way down in Ohio, and another lad in Ingersoll, and all kinds of people in Toronto and all around. I don't know how far they are. I was never there. I never used it often enough to get any distance. But I used to sit in with a fellow named Bill Choate in Toronto. Now, Bill had a quarter kilowatt set or something like that, and a very good outfit. And he lived not far from where I was. And I don't know who he was working with, but he went up to the Arctic in about 1925 or something. Well, it was one of those American expeditions. But I got my introduction to various frequencies and so on through him and this amateur work, you see. And it was certainly a valuable thing to me ever afterwards.
Yeah.
My professional life as well.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that and kept my operating in too.
Well, tell me, you know, just to go back a little bit, Bill, to the time when you're taking the course on servicing the actual sets and all that sort of thing, which again would be a great benefit to you. What happened after
that?
Well, that
wasn't much benefit. All that was doing, I was winding transformers day in and after day with little fine enameled or silk wire. Later on, they did away with all that, and they baked them all in a little bit of a thing.
Yeah.
But there was nothing much.
Really, an instrument mechanic, presumably an instrument mechanics course.
Yeah.
What we would call it today, but it didn't cover.
I would talk a little bit about how to file and one thing.
Well, tell me, in this time now, you're there in 1916, 1917, and presumably 1918. For example, did you ever get a leave to Blighty?
I was 18 months before I got a leave to Blighty.
Yeah.
I was 18 months. And then I went over to England, and I met a cousin of mine, and we went up to Scotland and visited an old friend of ours. That wasn't very long.
Yeah.
And then I come back. I don't know, that was after the Somme sometime.
Yeah.
Or way after that.
Yeah.
And then the next leave I had was after the Amiens show. And I went to Paris and I went down to Nice.
Oh, boy.
And I was back in Paris when the Austrians quit. And I was sitting around the YMCA or something there one night, and somebody came in and said, anybody going back to Corps? So I got a ride back with Willis O'Connor in a station wagon.
Willis O'Connor?
He was ADC to Curry.
Oh,
yeah,
for
heaven's sake. Mrs. Willis O'Connor lived about a half a block from us in Rockcliffe in Ottawa.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Well, he'd been down to Paris. The Prince of Wales was there.
So they were quite.
And he wanted something, so he was down there. So I got a ride back with him, right to Valenciennes. And of course, we were only there, and we moved on from there. Mons, the finish at Mons was just a couple of days later.
Yeah. Do you remember, or would you have had anything to do, for example, with the tanks, or the tank corps, the armor corps?
No, I remember seeing one at the Somme when they first took part there.
Yeah, that was 1916. All right, let me ask you another question. I'll stop this.
Can you hand this over to Bill?
One thing that was asked me, and I must say I didn't know, and that was the extent to which wireless communication was used between the Army, the ground, and the Air Force. Now, as you remember, can you remember anything of that at all?
I don't think so. I don't think, I had no recollection of that at all. I know that after the war, that we got a number of old Air Force sets, wireless sets, back. From England, and we modified those as usual. And they didn't come into service, I don't think, until the end of the war. I do know this, that at the end of the war, I was down in Belgium. After we'd been up in Germany, we reorganized all our wireless kits and rehabilitated them all for the trip up into Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these CW sets then, so that wireless communication was pretty good up there.
Yeah.
And we were only up there, what, a couple of weeks or a month, I've forgotten. And I remember we went to a lecture in the university in Bonn with some German professor who spoke English. And I had a nice picture of our wireless section taken in front of the great bridge at Cologne, with the big cathedral in the back, and I sent that down to Vimy. But the wireless worked very well up there, and I got to ride a motorcycle a little bit there. I got down as far as Koblenz, down the Rhine, and
You'd be around 22, 23 at that time.
Let me see, 18. Yeah, about 22, 22 and a half.
Yeah. And you decided, I assume, that when the war was over, that you were going to stay in the...
Well, I came back. I came back in... just before we get on to this. When Colonel Steele, or Major Steele, or Lieutenant Steele was with us, he kept some pretty good records and notes, and after the war, he wrote a series of articles in the Defense Quarterly.
Ah, yeah.
And
we have that at the university, by the way.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
The Defense Quarterly.
Yeah.
Well, it was in about 15 different parts.
Yeah.
But I had taken out, I had collected each one of those series and had them bound. And that is in the library.
That
was in the library. I don't know where the hell it is now.
Yeah.
I've only got a few chapters of it myself. And I thought I had more of them, but that's one of them, written after the war on the history of the NWT thing that he wrote to start off.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Bless my soul. Bless my soul.
Yeah. But I have several of the chapters at home in their magazines.
Yeah.
Home,
yeah.
But I think I'm the only one that ever took them out and had them bound, unless he did himself.
Yeah.
No,
you
this stuff went to the archives.
Yeah, yeah. To the Dominion Archives.
Yes,
yeah.
I believe so.
Right.
Along
right.
with a lot of his pictures, a lot of which I took, too.
Yeah. Did you yourself, during that time, keep a diary or anything of that nature?
Oh, once in a while I had a piece. I came across a little, came across one the other day, before I came out here, a little bit of it, but...
Yeah.
Couldn't keep one consistently.
Yeah.
And I had a camera. I took a few pictures.
Yeah.
He was a great photographer.
Which, yeah, I know.
Which you weren't supposed to have.
Yeah. What about the letters that you may have written home? Did anyone save those?
No.
They didn't?
No.
Damn.
No.
That's a shame. That's a shame.
Well, I came back in the middle of June.
Yeah, I was going to say, where did you end the war?
I
you said that you were in Germany, but I mean,
when the war
ended.
Down in Belgium.
Oh, yeah.
Down in Belgium, after we came back from Bonn, we ended up in Belgium, and then the old timers all got away first.
Yeah.
And another lad and I took all the stores by rail to Calais.
Yeah.
From there, from Jodoyne in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long we were there. We rode in these old boxcars with the scrippin'.
Yeah.
And when we got there, it was just dumped out on the platform, period. Rows and rows, miles of it there that everybody else had been there to. Just dumped out there in the open air, all this stuff.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
So we went over to England, and this guy shot himself. Because I was spent 2 days with, 3 days down there.
Oh God.
You depressed
by purposely or accidentally?
Purposely.
Yeah.
Committed suicide.
What rank were you when you entered the war, by the way? What rank were you?
Oh, I was, well, I tell you, by the one score I was a lance corporal, and by the other, by my medals, I'm a second corporal.
Oh, I see. And what medals did you get during the war?
Oh, just the usual service medals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No VC or anything like that.
No,
yeah.
No VC.
You're alive. Yeah. Did you ever meet up with Curry?
Yes, I've seen Curry.
Yeah.
I've seen Curry.
He's a most, to look at his picture, he's a most unsoldierly looking soldier.
Yes, yeah.
But evidently a good corps commander.
He bulges at the seams.
Yes, golly,
I think he was a good corps commander.
Yeah.
Colonel Ford spoke very highly of him.
Who was he?
Our Corps. Colonel Ford of the Signals.
Oh, I see.
Our director
for
years and years.
Yeah.
And I know he borrowed my great folk to go down to his funeral in Montreal.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. But we'll end this now in just a minute, but I just wanted you, in brief, you decide to stay in the Army, am I right?
Well, I didn't decide. I came back, and 2 weeks after I came back, I went into Toronto and enrolled in summer course to get me entrance into SPS.
What's that?
School of Practical Science.
Engineering.
I see. Okay.
And so we had a woman there teaching us mathematics, or trying to. She didn't make much of a fizz on me, and I still carried this up for 2 years. But anyway, I went to college, and I think I was probably influenced in that by a cousin of mine who graduated from there in 1914.
Mm-hmm.
And he never went overseas because he was very badly crippled with asthma. But I was very fond of him, and so I decided I wanted to be an engineer, I guess.
Yeah.
And this radio was interesting to me. And I took this summer course, and then we started out in the class of 1923.
Mm-hmm.
And 400 people, nearly all returned men.
Yeah.
Four.
Yeah.
Yes,
my God. Incidentally, this, when you were going to college, did you do it as we did after the Second World War? Was this a DVA thing, or did you pay for it privately, or do you remember?
No. I was given nothing, excepting that I had something coming to me from...
Yeah, you'd have some.
Saved
that's
up.
Right.
And so on.
Yeah.
It wasn't until my third year that I got a loan, free of interest.
Right.
To finish my fourth year.
Yeah.
And then I didn't get that paid back till after I came back from Hudson Street.
Yeah. And you'd be living at home at this time?
No, I had to live in the city.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I lived in the city, I boarded.
Yeah.
I lived in North House while the University College residences for my last year.
Yeah.
My last 2 years, I guess.
Yeah. What about summer?
Summer holidays. I went up. I was wireless operator on the SS Assiniboia on the CPR boat going up from Port Winnicott to Fort William.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of fun.
Oh,
that'd
yeah.
Good.
Oh, yes. I love that.
Yeah.
And. And then one summer I worked for a friend of mine, my third year I guess, I worked for a friend of mine, two of his uncles married two of my aunts.
That's a good connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we knew the family, and he had a little machine shop in way out in Main Street in Toronto, and he made toys, and he undertook to make some radios, and I helped him with that a bit.
Did he ever amount, did he ever become a
thing? He tell you where he made some money at was he made some very good coin-operated things for one thing and another.
Yeah.
And he made money on these coin-operated things for parking meters.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Good for him. Well, I think we better end it at that point, because I don't want to get you all. Okay, today is Monday, the 14th of April, 1986, and we're at the Chateau Victoria, and it's an interview with Colonel Laurie, formerly of the Royal Canadian Corps of Signals, and Dr. Roy. Okay, sir, we're up and away.
Now, when we left off, we had you, where?
Well...
The war was over, the First World War was over, and you were...
Just finishing school, eh?
You were just finishing...
Finishing university.
Yeah, now, and am I right in thinking that was in Toronto?
Yes, yes.
And I think you also mentioned that during the summer, you were a wireless operator on board one of the lake steamers.
I had been for the first 2 years, I think. And then I worked for my friend of mine one summer. And in the summer of, or in the fall of 1922, I was asked by Captain Jennett, who was then the district signal officer in Toronto, to join the militia, and he wanted me to teach a class in line telegraphy down at the old armories on University Avenue in Toronto.
How did you run into him, by the way? Or
well,
who
I'd never met him before. He just called me up. I guess some of the people in Ottawa, Major Steele, probably prompted him, you see.
Yeah.
Because he knew me during the war.
Uh-huh.
And so I was I was pretty busy, but I decided I would do it anyway, and I went down there, and I run two or three nights a week, and I had to do a little bit of work to prepare for it, but not very much. Everything was elementary, you know. And but one of the pupils was Fred Burgess. And Fred Burgess later on became my second in command of the First Corps Signals. Then in the about graduation time, would I like to go out to Manitoba to look after the radio for the Air Force on their forestry patrol out there? And so I decided that would be a good holiday, and I went out there. I went to Camp Borden first, and Archie St. Louis was the OC signals and the chief instructor, and general factotum there, ran the signal school, and we didn't have a mess of our own. We joined the Air Force mess up there.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, excuse me, what was your rank at this time?
I was a provisional lieutenant, I guess.
Yeah.
In the militia.
In the militia, right.
Yes.
And this would be sort of a summer job.
This was a summer job. But when I got to Borden, why, they said, how would you like to join the permanent force? And we'll give you leave without pay to go back and finish your fourth year. So I became a lieutenant in the permanent force.
I see.
Something like April the 23rd in 1923.
Yeah.
And well, I was there at Borden for a while, and then I went out to Winnipeg. I don't know, I think I was on my own out there, and they shipped some stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
We put up, the engineers put up a little bit of a shack in Port Osborne Barracks for our radio station there, and put up a couple of masts, and I left an NCO in charge of that, and went off down to Victoria Beach, which was their main base.
Well, you say,
they were all on floats, you see.
Oh, you're talking about the Air Force?
Flying boats, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the CO was, I guess he was a squadron leader there at the time. Squadron leader. Well, I can't think of his name now, but anyway, the other Air Force officers were Stevenson from Vancouver here.
Yeah.
He's an Air Vice Marshal now.
Yeah.
And either George Howsam there, or I'd seen him the year before out at High River, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And a non-permanent chap by the name of Ryan, and Leo Sharon, and another Kenny, the other officers there. And we had quite a good time there.
Now, what was the relationship between the station that you established at Fort Osborne and these airplanes?
The stores keeper for the Air Force was at Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And that was a channel for him out there, and anybody wanting to get back with messages to Winnipeg, you see.
Yeah.
Headquarters or onto Ottawa or anything like that.
Yeah.
And
in other words, the Air Force didn't have their own signal station.
In Winnipeg, no.
Yeah.
No, just this one which I had set up.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the summer, I lost some of the NCOs. They went down to Ottawa, and they were then brought out by Major Steele on his way up to the Yukon to establish the first stations up in the Yukon. And that was to be followed the following year by stations all up the Mackenzie River,
mm-hmm.
which would then connect with those in the Yukon. But this fellow, Frank Riddell, was one. Bill Lockhart was another
mm-hmm.
that I had out there. And Heath, Sergeant Heath, the fellow in charge of the Winnipeg station, he went to Dawson, was in charge of the station out there. But we had no equipment in the planes, just the ground stations there.
I see. So your station in Osborne would be between Osborne and Victoria Beach?
And Victoria Beach.
Rather than Osborne and any of the aircraft?
Yes. That's right.
I see.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think I showed you a picture of a 120 watt set there.
Yeah.
That's what they used at the time.
Would that be voice or?
No, it was all key.
All key.
And we had, I think we had power into Winnipeg there.
Yeah.
But the other places had a little Delco engine too, and some batteries to run there.
Yeah.
Old was very simple, you know,
yeah.
nothing complex about it, but it worked very well.
Yeah, good.
And we got weather reports, you see, back and forth between Norway House and Winnipeg, so that when they were making the odd flights up there, they didn't fly up between the bases very often.
Yeah.
They had their own routine flights for forestry observation at each base.
Yeah. Did you ever get on any of the flights yourself, by the way?
Oh, I went up to Norway House once or twice, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They had the old HS2L flying boats. They were old wartime things. And the first Vickers Viking came out there.
Yeah.
That was, that came out. Squadron leader Bredner flew that out there, I remember.
I'll be damned.
And then in the autumn I went back to Toronto, and I think I ran another course in the wintertime there down in the armies.
Mm-hmm.
I finally got through in the spring, and I went, I'm not sure whether I went to Camp Borden for a while after graduation, and then I went to Ottawa, where we were getting ready to go out to, I was detailed to build a station in Edmonton at Southern Terminus. And Lieutenant Galbraith went to Fort Simpson, and Hugh Young went to Aklavik, or the original station was at Herschel Island, off just off Aklavik, mm-hmm. about 100 miles up the coast yeah. towards the American border. And Fort Simpson and our equipment was shipped by rail and boat out there. The equipment for Herschel Island was sent to Vancouver and loaded on the Lady Kindersley mm-hmm. to go around Point Barrow. And she got nipped in the ice off Point Barrow and was lost. So Hugh Young and Frank Waddell was with him. They were left there with the mounted police on the island.
Yeah.
And when the they had no outside contact there. And when the boat didn't show up, why, they felt that the worst had happened. Mm. And Young, he bought some dogs mm. from the Eskimos or the police, I'm not sure which.
Yeah.
And he and Riddell, they made their way over to Aklavik. And in the meantime, well, we knew what had happened in Ottawa, and well, I wasn't in Ottawa until the fall, until about Christmas time, but they knew what had happened, and so they decided that for the next year they would rebuild the station at Aklavik rather than Herschel Island. And I didn't have much to do with the building of the station in Edmonton, excepting that the building was let out to tender all through some federal representative in Edmonton who was, everything had to be wired back to Ottawa for to see that the contractor was the right stripe and so on.
Yeah.
But one thing I remember, before I left Ottawa, Bert May, he was Captain H. True May, was the adjutant there. And he said to me that when you get to Edmonton, you must look up Brigadier, and I can't for the life of me remember his name now, but he was had been a brigadier in the First War.
Mm-hmm.
And May, I presume, had been his signals officer
yeah.
there. So, oh, Griesbach.
Griesbach.
Yeah. Brigadier Griesbach. That was his name. And so I called on the brigadier in due course, and he regaled to me his experiences of the West. He said, "My boy, I was mayor of this town when I was 20. So I never saw him again, but I used to see his wife padding up and down the streets of Edmonton in moccasins in the cold weather in
yeah.
the wintertime.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got the station in operation about sometime in October, and Simpson came on about the same time. We were almost neck and neck, I think, and we had no trouble getting communication with each other, and he with Mayo in Dawson City.
Mm-hmm.
But after getting the formal messages from the Gold Commissioner of the Yukon and the minister in Ottawa, getting the formal messages through, my transmitter went on the, became faulty. Actually, it was the generator which gave out. We had 2,000 volt direct current generators,
mm-hmm.
and driven by eventually batteries and a motor. But the generator gave out, and on creating the spare, we found it was a spare for the motor, not for the generator. So we were without any communication for a while. And having been to High River the year before, and the year before, and knowing what they had in the way of a transmitter down there, I don't know whether I had any authority. I can't remember whether I tried to get authority or not. But anyway, I went to High River and persuaded them to allow me to use their transmitter and equipment to communicate with Simpson, which worked out beautifully.
Yeah.
And any few messages, I think we managed to get around somehow or other, but it wasn't anyway. The formal thing being over with, we got by.
Now this again is still all by key.
Yes, all by key.
Now tell me, you mentioned these stations that you have up the Mackenzie River and here, there and the other place. Were these stations to allow the mounted police to communicate back, or?
Everybody, all government branches. Government branches, and we took in paid traffic from anybody else. And we connected with the Canadian National Lines at Edmonton.
I see. So it was sort of an army,
army network. Yes.
I see.
Yeah. And then I turned the station over to a new chap that had never had any army experience. He'd been with the old telegraph system out from way up in BC here to the Yukon.
Yeah.
So this was something to supersede that.
Yeah.
And Major Steele had met this guy out there, and so he took over from me. And he knew the code, and he knew about traffic and that sort of thing, but. I left a very good senior NCO there to run the equipment, and it got on the air again in due time.
Yeah.
And I went back to Ottawa about Christmas time, and I don't remember what I did, excepting that there was ongoing equipment and to be got ready for the following years.
Mm.
A station that Fort Smith, and then the distributor, the Governor General, was going down to the Arctic in 1925, and Major Steele went with him, and they put a set of equipment on the old paddle wheel distributor, which was then able to communicate with Fort Simpson and Edmonton. And
That's up the Mackenzie.
And Fort Smith, down the Mackenzie.
Yeah, good God. So that would be probably the first ship on the inside of Canada. Well, no, maybe not. But it would be surely the first ship going up north of the Arctic Circle.
Oh, yes.
With any sort of radio communication.
Oh, yes. I don't think they ever had it on for years afterwards. It was taken off. And, but nowadays, of course, well, it's a different matter.
Yeah.
But, there were a multitude of small stations in the ensuing years where, by mining companies and so on, that established stations to connect with ours. And, I flew up to Yellowknife on one occasion when we were building a new station in there.
Mm.
And and then these stations were constantly being moved and so on. And in 1925, I came out to Calgary to be district signal officer there. So, and while I was there, I was told to keep a watchful eye on both the High River Station and Edmonton,
mm-hmm.
which I did, and I lived and I shared an accommodation with a fellow named Reg Mitchell of the PPC.